The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
When I suggested to Carol Payton we'd have a new board by Friday, she went, oh, no, it takes far too long. We've got to find people who are prepared to do it. And, oh, no, and then there's a process. And certainly, Primer Gordon has moved with lightning speed in terms of appointing the new board at Eskom. 18 months overdue, that board was. And we'll get some professional views on that board this evening because it looks interesting. The Money Show brought to you by Absa CIB. Tune into the Absa Insight Series podcast and gain a better understanding of the non-bank financial institution sector. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP. Welcome to the Money Show this evening. Does a board make the slightest bit of difference when it comes to the operations of an entity as difficult and as broken and as shell-shocked as Eskom is? One certainly hopes so, but I'll get the view of a professional this evening. We'll also reflect a little on Rain's proposal to Telkom and Kevin Ling's, the chief economist at StanLib. Trickle-down economics, it's something that Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, her finance minister, the chancellor of the Exchequer, are trying. Trickle-down economics, make the rich richer. Money then sort of trickles down through the economy and everybody benefits. That's the theory of trickle-down economics. What happens in practice? We'll play the Brutal Biz quiz. We'll talk to Victoria Juster, the chief executive of the South African Olive Industry Association. There we go. And then later on, of course, between 7 and 8, all the best bits from The Money Show from the week that has been.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
So have you heard the one about three engineers, two CAs, a nuclear officer, an energy management and climate change person, an auditor, a legal head, a finance person, and a bank chair? They all walk into a bar. They turn it into a boardroom. Government appointing a new Eskom board today. It's a mix of skills, some big names. The Nedbank chair, Mpo Makwana, back at Eskom, previously was on that board 9 years ago, for 9 years. From 2002 all the way to 2011, when he was fired by Malusi Gigaba. He will chair Eskom once again. He was briefly CEO for a bit as well. The energy analyst Chris Yelland with us this evening. He is the managing director at EE Business Intelligence. And I see you saying nice things about this board, Mr. Yelland.
Well, I must say I'm very relieved and heartened that we're not seeing some of the noisy, populist, discredited former Eskom executives, their acting CEOs of the past, their CEOs of the past, including the criminally implicated tweeting engineer being appointed to Eskom board. It's really pleasing me.
If you compare this board, Chris, sorry to interrupt, this board compared to some of the boards, and there have been many over the last 15 years or so, that have had an astonishing array of clueless incompetence in many of the boards over time, this is an astonishing improvement.
Absolutely. Take a look at the board appointed by Lynn Brown, a bunch of Gupta stooges. Really, it is, one can say nothing more than that. This board, is appointments of respected professionals, a diverse background, the kind of skills that you need on a board. It's very heartening to see this. And thank goodness it has come. And, you talked a little earlier that it's happened so quickly. But remember, the board has been depleted for a long time, and people have been calling on the minister to appoint a new board. Or reconstituted board, and perhaps a lot of the work had been done, and this was the final last straw that made sure that the minister got it together at a critical time.
The relative ease with which it was constituted, we were chatting earlier this week about it and saying, who would actually want to stake their reputation on Eskom, their reputation on a board which has been routinely meddled with by government? It's a board that has been, it's so badly mismanaged for so long that who would want to put their name up for it? But there's some very big names in there. Mpo Makwana has been around the block once or twice at Eskom, and now I think he's retires from Nedbank chair in May next year. We've got Mteto Nyati, the turnaround specialist at Altron. He's done very well in there too. And a whole bunch of other very senior executives from across the business sphere. And it strikes me that this is a board of well-meaning South African citizens who want to make a difference. At least we hope so.
Yeah, I think so too. I know a few of the board members personally, Paul being one of them, Tekani Ntabeni being the other. You know, he comes from Goldfields and Impala. And also Dr. Rod Crompton comes from the Department of Energy, had many years of service there. He was on the board member of NERSA, and he has continued in this role. So there's some very good names that I know. There are many that I don't know, but I know of them. I'm really pleased. I don't think it was easy to constitute this board. As I say, I think perhaps some of the work had been done over a period of time. So it looked like it was a sudden appointment, but actually, I think, it took a lot of effort to put this board together.
I was initially surprised to see former General Secretary of COSATU, Becky Ntshali-Ntshali, on this board. But if the board does what is necessary to be done, you're going to need somebody who understands trade union workings very, very well in order to start whittling down the huge overheads at Eskom, one of the biggest of which, of course, is an overpopulated staff complement.
Well, I do think it's important to have Labour people on the board, and this is not the first time that there has been somebody from the Labour movement. Sometimes they are critical, but they are one voice that needs to be heard, and I think that's important. So I think it was a good move.
And then these are not people who are going to put on overalls and get into the bowels of Kusile and Modupi and plug the leaks in the boiler systems and the piping and all of that sort of stuff. Does the appointment of a brand new board do anything other than in a year or two perhaps see some better outcomes? In the short term, we're still stuck with a catastrophic performance of an Eskom fleet.
Yeah, I think we mustn't have the kind of unreasonable expectations that this board is going to suddenly change around the performance of Eskom. Look, a board doesn't run the company, as you well know. That is what the executives and the layers of management do, and the power station managers and the people of Eskom. The board is very important. It performs an oversight role and a governance role. And it also acts as a layer of communication between the executives and the minister. The CEO must earn the support of the board. If the CEO does no longer have the support of the board will no doubt communicate that to the minister, and the minister will be aware that there's a problem that needs some action. But I don't think we must expect that the board, as you say, is going to roll up their sleeves and go into the power stations and do those kind of things. But certainly they are there to look at the oversight, make sure that right procedures and processes are followed, and they keep a close eye on the management, work with the management, and the management have to earn the support of the board. Without the support of the board, the management is likely to be changed in due course by the minister, remembering that the minister appoints the CEO and the COO and the CFO.
Thank you very much to Chris Yelland this evening, the energy analyst and MD at EE Business Intelligence, with his relief, I think, at who is on the board and his relief at who is not on the board as well. All kinds of charlatans putting themselves forward, and certainly in the public domain, whether they put themselves forward in a serious way to be considered and were rejected, we don't know the answer to that question. The adults very much back in charge. The last board was good too, but it was just should have been reconstituted earlier. And this is a more engineering heavy board than perhaps the previous one. And yeah, they've got as good a chance as any, but it's about getting everybody and the strategy right for Eskom, and actually beginning to talk back to, and let's see if that can happen, to Department of Public Enterprises, Department of Energy, and saying, listen, you want a utility that works, you want a sustainable utility, this is the way it's going to work. And hopefully this is the team that is able to do it. Certainly some high-powered and high-caliber individuals on this board.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Rain very much stepping into the action at Telkom. And you've got Telkom as this weird bell of the ball. It's Rain today tabling a formal proposal to merge with Telkom. Two statements actually related to Telkom today. MTN also reminding us it's interested. It's gone through a process already with Telkom. There's a bit of to and fro still there. And of course, Rain finally stepping in with a formal proposal. Remember, when they first made their proposal, they were told they'd not done it properly. They should withdraw the proposal. Duncan McLeod, the founder and editor, Tech Central, on the line to us this evening. Whoever thought that Telkom would be so sought after as an asset, Duncan McLeod. But yeah, Rain formally stepping back into the game today. Is it going to be an interesting fight, do you think?
Well, this whole story today is really interesting. First of all, the timing by Telkom that around the statement is interesting because Rain, they revealed, actually tabled this proposal about 2.5 weeks ago. So immediately raises some questions as to why Telkom is putting out a thin statement 2.5 weeks after the fact that Rain tabled this proposal to their board. And at the same time, it has put noses out of joint at MTN, who feel that they should be in exclusive discussions with Telkom about a transaction, which prompted the very strangely worded MTN statement a bit later in the day, a few hours after Telkom put out its statement saying that its board was engaging with Rain about their proposal. MTN, on the other hand, then put out a statement saying that they had considered the statement issued by Telkom and said that they had written to Telkom's board and said they apparently were not happy with the latest turn of developments and basically hinted strongly that they could walk away from the transaction. Basically, it looks like MTN feels like jilted lovers here, the jilted lover here, rather, and that Telkom has gone off and engaged with Rain. Now, these are two very different proposed transactions. Telkom has revealed that Rain has actually proposed that Telkom buy Rain, whereas MTN is in talks to buy Telkom. So it's all rather interesting, and there seems to be some unhappiness being communicated in a public forum, being the JSE Sends News Service today.
What deal is in the best interests of South Africa in terms of efficient, competitive cell phone and connectivity? What is actually in all of our best interest? Is it a Rain Telkom tie-up? Is it MTN taking over Telkom and Rain continuing on its own?
I mean, at face value, a Telkom and MTN tie-up would seem to massively reduce competition because you've got two major players in the market getting together. Where the Rain Telkom tie-up would, at face value, appear to be more consumer-friendly in that this is a small challenger operator merging with one of the bigger players in the market, and we'd still remain essentially a three-player market in South Africa. But the other argument could be made that maybe Telkom is too small relative to Vodacom and MTN to compete meaningfully. You know, that we know that they struggle to compete with the two bigger rivals on CapEx. So there is a valid argument to be made that, you know, that maybe Telkom just isn't big enough to compete with the two big boys, and that maybe a two-player market would make more sense. There are arguments to both sides here, and I'm sure the economists are going to be weighing in on this in a great amount of detail if this ever gets to be looked at by the Competition Commission. What's really interesting, Bruce, is that as I understand it, both MTN and Telkom have to renew their cautionary notices, which is a requirement of the JSE every so often. They have to inform shareholders and inform investors that they're still in discussions.
Oh, and we've lost you, Duncan McLeod. Thank you very much indeed. Duncan McLeod, who is the founder and editor at Tech Central, two bids in for the attentions and the affections of Telkom.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
So what makes more sense to you? Raising taxes on the rich and using that money to allow support for the poorest in society, social grants, free healthcare, education, that sort of stuff? Or do you ensure that the rich, who have proven their ability to generate wealth, and should get big fat tax cuts so that the money they no longer have to hand over to government goes into building more of what they've already created? It makes sense too. The latter part is referred to as trickle-down economics. Make the rich richer, then the largesse will filter down through the economy and everybody gets to benefit. Tonight's Money Show Explainer, what exactly is trickle-down economics and does it work? Kevin Lings, chief economist at StanLib. We're asking this question, of course, because this is Britain's new economic strategy, trickle-down economics 1980 style. Kevin, what exactly is trickle-down economics?
Well, Bruce, I thought you explained it pretty well.
Well, thank you. Okay, the technical terms.
It's essentially, it comes from an area called supply-side economics, and what it says is that you need to provide some sort of stimulus through tax cuts. And you've got choices on who you're going to cut taxes for. And in this instance, you tend to cut taxes more for rich or high-income earners. And you cut a variety of taxes. You could just cut income tax, but you could equally cut capital gains tax, or you could cut dividend taxes. It also has an element of it where you say, I'm going to cut the business tax. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to use that tax cut as a way to stimulate the economy. And you're arguing that those individuals will then respond very positively to those tax cuts. They'll spend more money. And because they now are more encouraged, they're more confident, they may well undertake additional investment and they may well expand their existing businesses. And as a result, you get a larger or multiplier impact on the economy, so much so that generates a whole lot of additional tax revenue, and the additional tax revenue that you collect then far exceeds the tax cut that you've introduced, and as a result, the government's better off and the economy's better off. Sounds beautiful.
It does sound beautiful, and there is a certain cold, hard capitalist logic to it. Does it work?
So there is a logic to it, and it can be appealing, and there is some science behind it. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked. The argument is always made that Reagan in the 80s, President Reagan, did this type of initiative and that it had success. I think that lens tends to exclude a number of other measures that President Reagan introduced at the same time, some of which was just outright increased government spending. And so I think there's too much credit given to those specific supply-side measures at the time when Reagan was around. Subsequent to that, no. Pretty much in most instances where it's been tried, it hasn't worked. It's tended to result in increased deficits. In other words, the government has less money available because they've just given a tax cut. They don't get the commensurate increase in economic activity. And so you end up being worse off, although rich people end up feeling a hell of a lot better. And part of the reason for that is those rich individuals, there's a high propensity for those individuals to externalize a lot of that money. That money may well go into offshore investments, or it may go into offshore purchases, luxury purchases. The person may decide, geez, I've got this tax break I never thought I was going to have. Let me buy a luxury car that is fully imported. And you don't get the domestic benefit that you really want. And so the IMF, not that long ago, wrote a research, actually a very good research paper on this, a whole lot of economists involved, and they concluded that, no, while it was a reasonable proposition, it doesn't really work, and it's not something to pursue actively as a policy item.
Yet the UK seems wedded to this idea. At least the new government under Liz Truss seems to think this is a terribly good idea. She's not read a textbook since the Reagan years. Is that the problem, or what is actually at play here?
It's hard to know what their thinking is. I mean, you can argue that the tax rates on high-income earners is high and there should be some reduction there. That's one argument, but it's not part of I don't think it's a valid argument within this context that the UK finds themselves. The main problem here is that you are fighting your own central bank and you're creating this massive conflict, and your own central bank can't back down. So that conflict is going to escalate. In other words, their central bank will raise interest rates, and any tax cuts that you push through are going to be largely negated by
the increase in interest rates. And so any sort of idea of, well, I'm going to invest more in my small business or anything like that, you as a rich individual, you'll think twice about it because you know that interest rates are going to go up and you know that that's going to hurt the economy. So in this instance, it's got less chance of working. Why exactly are they trying it? I think it's an initiative to get the economy going, to create some relief in terms of the cost of living. But when you think about who's been impacted by the cost of living, if you think about what would really make a difference, it doesn't feel like it's likely to be an effective policy.
Thank you, Kevin Lings, Chief Economist at StanLib. Now you know all about trickle-down economics.
The Money Show.
The markets.
To David Shapiro at Sasfin. Now, you've had an interesting time in markets over the years, David Shapiro. When last did you feel as wild and woolly as you do right now, based on the way in which markets are behaving?
Not for a long time, Bruce. I think, it's almost the same kind of feeling we had in March 2020 when the coronavirus broke and economies closed down their borders, cities closed down their borders, businesses closed down. We didn't know what's next. And I get that feeling now. I love what Kevin said. You know, you were talking about Reaganomics going back to the 80s. You know, the Fed here is going back to the 80s as well. You know, so we're all using those old playbooks. And no one's really, there is no modern economics on how to deal this. And I think that's why we got these markets. It's really an indication that people don't know what's coming next. They've lost faith in the leaders and, markets are all over the place. So it's not a secure feeling, Bruce, you know, if that's what you want to know. It's not, one doesn't feel comfortable about where we are.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, discomfort is part of markets. Discomfort is part of what makes and breaks fortunes. And is there anything fundamentally different about this market, the way in which it's behaving relative to other booms and busts that you've seen?
No, not really. I mean, you have to tough it out and you have to go through it. I think what will happen, you know, in this case, and listening to your interview with Kevin, and talking about the UK, where they want to stimulate investment. In this case, I think the Fed is actually rubbing its hands. This is exactly what it wanted. It wanted people to feel a lot poorer. It wanted them to feel pain. And by doing that, they won't go out and spend. They won't go out and buy those luxury cars or do anything like that. They'll start to save. And this will hurt the demand side of the economy. I think the problem is that I reckon we're going into a period where we actually need fixed investment. We need investment, and Biden's whole plan is around investment. You know, make America better. I can't get his exact phrase, but you can help me on that one. But it's a worry. They need to fix the infrastructure here. They need to start spending more on renewable energies and so on. So it's an economy that is actually, I think, needy for investment. And the last thing you want to do is to carpet bomb the whole economy which the Fed is trying to do. So that's where this discomfort is coming. Yeah. You know, Bruce, I've always believed, you know, I've always said that never believe that the people in charge know what they're doing. And I think just taking my interview, hopefully, and listening to Kevin with talking about Liz Truss, you know, you get that same feeling, you know, oi, do they really know what they're doing?
I mean, you're in Boston in the United States this evening. You've been to the United States many, many times. You like the environment. You like to hang out. You run the New York Marathon from time to time, or you have in the past. I mean, from an inflationary perspective, do you feel it's different from previous times that you visited?
No, not really. Not from my point of view. And I've been keeping my eyes open. I think going to New York, it's still suffering from COVID. It's still suffering from the lockdown. There's so many shops that have been closed down and so on. And the pity is that as it's trying to come back, they're now going to be hit with higher interest rates. But I don't get that feeling, you know, when you catch a taxi or alternatively go on the underground or go buy a loaf of bread or a kitka or a challah, as they call it in America, one doesn't get a feeling that prices have gone through the roof. But I suppose if you talk to most Americans, you know, who do count their dollars and or cents, they might be finding it, particularly on the fuel side. But, you know, for us from South Africa, that's nothing. I mean, we're so used to it, you know. They're sissies in that respect, yeah.
David Shapiro, they're from Sasman. Thank you very much. On the line to us from Boston in the United States this evening. Thank you, David.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB. To revive Africa's growth ambitions, you need to understand the alternative finance market. Absa does. Gain a better understanding of the non-bank financial institution sector and tune into the Absa Insight Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Olive oil, traditionally regarded as a very expensive addition to the household grocery cupboard. But if you look at the explosion in oil prices worldwide over the last couple of months, everything from canola oil to sunflower oil, prices have escalated dramatically. Canola oil by about 40%, sunflower by about 55% over the last quarter or so. And it does mean that particularly restaurants, which use a lot of cooking oil, are feeling a lot of pain. Olive oil is by no means cheap, but suddenly relative to the other oils, it's a lot more affordable, but something still of a luxury. So it is the subject of tonight's Friday File. We'll speak to Vittoria Uester, the chief executive at the South African Olive Industry Association, in just a little bit. Coming up on the next Money Show, we're joined by Xolile Tshabalala on Other People's Money, actress, the Netflix's Blood and Water, also, of course, has been in Generations. You'll know her from there. Ian Mann, the managing director at Gateway's Business Consultants, has been devouring books and will share the thoughts, insights, and wisdom of those books, particularly Embracing Creative Tensions to Solve Your Toughest Problems. Make get copies for the Eskom board, plus, of course, all the other big money stories of the day. Next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Olive oil, massively expensive, unaffordable, you say. But South Africa's got a growing olive oil industry. I think we probably still import more than we manufacture locally. But let's get the science of it all with Vittoria Uester, Chief Executive at the South African Olive Industry Association. This industry is expanding very, very nicely, Vittoria. I mean, everybody on wine farms nowadays seems to be planting a couple of olive trees. We've got olive plantations, exclusive olive plantations. How significant an industry is the olive industry in our country?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. Well, it's very significant in that it's still small by area under olive cultivation, and small compared to many other crops in the country, but significant in that, as you said, it has been experiencing a growth trajectory that seems to suggest that there's growth ahead. As you also referred to, we've got a situation where we are importing probably 2.5-3 times as much as we are producing, depending on the years and on the circumstances. So that means that there is a certain demand for olive oil in South Africa that is currently not satisfied by the local production for a number of reasons. So there is room for the industry to grow. And more importantly, there is a certain level of quality, a certain quality profile that South Africa has established in its olive oils, which is now recognized internationally. And that is probably its strongest point going forward.
Talk to me about quality, please, and how you determine quality of an olive oil. I mean, I've seen people sort of tasting olive oil like people taste wine, and there's lots of and all of that sort of stuff. It's that sort of. I mean, there's a level of expertise that is developed in the wine industry that makes Hannibal Lecter sound sane. It's wonderful to see.
Well, there are proper training courses. There are recognitions, and actually, our tasting panel, as the olives tasting panel for the first time, has been accredited by the International Olive Council. This is news from 2 days ago. Great. So we're very, very happy about that. We're one of the 128 panels in the world that have been accredited by the IOC. And yeah, going back to your point, how does one determine the quality of olive oil? Why do we say an oil is extra virgin over virgin olive oil. So first of all, there are certain chemical parameters that need to be, you know, measured in a specialized and accredited laboratory. And those have to do with the, you know, the peroxide, so that the amount of oxidation, say that the oil is undergone, and the free fatty acids. So those give you an indication of whether the oil has deteriorated to some extent. There's a certain threshold below which the oil has to be in those two parameters. Otherwise, it cannot be classified as extra virgin or virgin and so on.
Okay.
And that's the analytical side. Yeah.
Absolutely. But I, as a consumer, I stand on the shelf and there are 30 bottles of olive oil. They are range in price from not very expensive to considerably more pricey. There can be a sort of a 200% difference between the lowest and the most expensive on the shelf. How do I pick? How do I choose what is right?
Yeah. I would say don't go for the cheapest. I know that everybody's trying to spot the bargain, but rather make sure that the oil has possibly the SA Olive CTC seal. It's a oval seal that says SA Olive, it's green, and it tells you the year of harvest. So that's probably the greatest, say, reassurance that the consumer can look for, because they will tell when the oil was produced, which means you know more or less what type of shelf life it has, say 2 years hence, and you know that it's from South Africa, it's extra virgin, because we only put the sticker on oils that have been through the laboratory and the panel test and have been certified or verified, rather. And don't be swayed by those fancy sounding, you know, Italian and Spanish names, because unfortunately, very often those oils aren't even from, you know, from the country that where they've been bottled. And also very often they're not extra virgin olive oils, even though they're placed on the shelves in our retailers, maybe next to our beautiful local extra virgin, but they cannot compare in most of the times with the quality profile of ours. So as much as we need the imported oils to keep, you know, the consumers of olive oil happy so they don't switch to something else, since we cannot yet produce enough. At the same time, if a consumer is looking for a guarantee, look for the CTC seal, and at least you know what's in the bottle.
Okay, so the difference then between olive oil, the stuff that I might fry a chicken breast in, versus a virgin olive oil, which I may use in a salad dressing, or an extra virgin olive oil, where definitely there's a taste profile difference. I get that. Taking it out of the lab, I mean, the treatment of these different olive oils, why is there that different distinction between them beyond the pHs and the oxidization and all of that sort of stuff?
Well, yeah, there's obviously an important component relating to flavor. So if you take extra virgin olive oil, it is a fresh olive juice. So it's olives that have been somehow pressed and the olive oil has been extracted and then it has been separated from the water fraction and the oil has been filtered and nothing else has been done to it. There's no heating, no additives, nothing, and certainly no refining. So that is the most flavorful, the healthiest, because, you know, even though percentage-wise it's a very small percentage, say less than 3% or so, but those minor components in olive oil are where your antioxidants and, you know, all your polyphenols and all your anti-inflammatory substances are found. And so that's where you get the best, the most health benefits. So, I mean, ideally, if one could afford it, you would always look for extra virgin olive oil and use it for your salads, for cooking, for baking, to put on your ice cream and to rub it on your skin as well. And in your hair, if you wanted to. Clearly, we can't all be spending that amount of money. So we tend to differentiate. But certainly, we shouldn't, you know, think that you cannot cook with olive oil, because it has been demonstrated that it actually is, you know, is very good and it's very stable, even at high temperatures, the kinds of temperatures you would find in a kitchen in a pot, and it does not break down into any type of carcinogenic components. Yeah, I don't know if I answered your question.
No. It's wonderful. I just something that struck me. Rub on skin, rub on hair. Yes, okay, I've heard about all of this. Put it on ice cream. Was that just a turn of phrase or something quite serious?
No, it's lovely. If you put a bit of olive oil on a vanilla ice cream, or on a piece of pineapple.
I mean, no,
it's amazing what you, absolutely, I tried it. I don't know, experiment.
I have olive oil, I have pineapple at home, I have ice cream, I'm going to try it. And if I'm not here on Monday, You'll know.
You'll blame me.
Victoria, thank you very much for chatting this evening. It's wonderful to have heard from you, the chief executive of the SA Olive Industry Association. Learned a bit more about olive oil this evening. Thank you very much for enlightening us. Yeah, rub it on your hair. Go out and see if anybody sort of licks you. But put it on ice cream. Put it on pineapple. Look, I can try everything once. Well, not everything once, because some things you try once and you don't recover ever. But I think I could try that. Would you? George has got his nose turned up. George wouldn't. Brutal Biz Quiz time, which is what we need you to do tonight. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. If you'd like to play the Brutal Biz Quiz, I would love you to have you along and see whether or not you can outwit the team that has compiled a list of delightful questions for you this evening. There's a consultancy. It's been blackballed by National Treasury. It can't do business with government for the next 10 years. What will they do, you wonder? What is the name of this international consultancy banned from work in the UK for 3 years with government and in South Africa for the next 10 years? No doubt they'll repeat it and they'll tell us how good and what and nice they are. But I wonder the name of that company. 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. Give us a shot. Let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday evening.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show, brought to you by Absa CIB. Tune in to the Absa Insight Series podcast and gain a better understanding of the non-bank financial institution sector. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP. Which consultancy has been banned from doing business with the South African government? Morris at Newlands in Cape Town. Good evening to you, Morris. What is the name of the company?
Bain & Company.
It is absolutely Bain and Company, Morris. Absolutely. The UK suspended Bain for 3 years and the South African ban will run from the 5th of September 2022 to the 4th of September 2032. Which company has a race to be the biggest IPO in Europe this year?
In Europe?
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, I don't know that.
Thank you, Morris. Gerald and Joburg. There's a clue in... Oh, Gerald doesn't want to play either. Sudhir. There is a company spun out of Volkswagen. It's raced to become the biggest IPO in Europe this year. What is the name of that company, Sudhir?
Porsche.
Porsche is absolutely right. Porsche. Second largest ever in Germany, and with all of the chaos and all of the uncertainty in global markets, it's listed on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, and the listing seems to have gone quite well. Which airline is going to allow male cabin crew and pilots, should they choose to wear skirts?
I have no idea.
The founder has been seen in a skirt himself before, despite his beard.
I have no idea. Sorry.
Okay, there we go, Sudhir. Yatish in Winchester Hills.
Hi, Bruce.
Which airline allows male cabin crew to wear skirts?
Virgin Atlantic.
Virgin Atlantic. Richard Branson's not averse to wearing a skirt from time to time in public if it's going to promote his business. Absolutely right. Yatish, 100%. Who is Kwasi Kwarteng?
Forget that.
No, there are lots of people who wish they could forget him, Yatish. You mean in Pretoria? You mean? No. Yeah, that tells you that you're out. Kwasi Kwarteng, who is that? 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Who is Kwasi Kwarteng? No doubt the history books, if he is at all remembered, will ascribe Kwasinomics to him. Let's do that in a moment.
Let's go on a colour adventure. Visit your nearest Chamberlain from 23 September to 9 October and get your home brightened up for a wonderful summer. There are amazing offers on the widest range of paints. 15% off on Plascon Dulux and Chamber Value color mixing. It's a painting adventure for everyone. Chamberlain, famous for hardware since 1903 and soon to be famous in Kyle Army 2 with our new Kyle Army mega store opening 28 October.
Everyone's invited to SA's big birthday bed bash at Dialabed. Celebrate with savings of up to 35% off. Our 40-wing Sleep Pro queen set is now only $7,999. The Sealy Posturepedic Celebration queen set is now only $8,499. And the luxury Simmons Sofa Firm queen set is reduced to only $11,999. Our best sellers are ready for fast delivery. Dialabed, sleep for life.
702 was in conversation with Lottoland, discussing the brand new 13-part TV series, Dunkie Lottoland.
In 2021, we had to do a massive branding drive for Lottoland. And for those not understanding marketing that well, it's literally all your TV ads, radio ads, billboards. And this was right after the pandemic. And I just felt in my heart to really run these heart-hitting gambling ads for people that's really feeling the hurt after the pandemic. And we could see the pain and we can see all the trauma that South Africans actually had experienced with job losses. We thought of going out, taking that budget and giving it back to South Africans in need. And we thought of coming up with a TV show. And the reason for that is, A, that obviously that we can get brand awareness, but secondly, that the people at home can now actually see what these organizations do.
Don't miss the Dunkie Lottoland TV series, brought to you by Lottoland on 702.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Who is Kwasi Kwarteng, Robert in Pretoria?
Hi there, Bruce. It's the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the United Kingdom.
Absolutely. Kwasinomics is what it's going to be called in future, no doubt. Which local bank will soon be offering you data that doesn't expire?
Capitec.
Capitec, absolutely. It's really interesting as to how this crossover between banking and tech nowadays. Robert, your timing was impeccable. I have a whole lot of more questions, but not a whole lot more time, unfortunately. So, Robert, you become the Wizard of the Biz Quiz. Well done. Oh, and even a special applause. Jeez, George, you're getting generous this evening. In a moment, of course, Eyewitness News. We'll follow that with the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. In a moment.